You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, 1A's Record Club pays tribute to Tina Turner. They've been overwhelmed, they say, with listener responses. They'll share what people have to say about the musical legend. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, when you buy a product, a phone, a computer printer, a car, a coffee maker, piece of farm equipment, do you own it? Easy question, right? Of course you own it. You bought it. But our next guest says, wait, not so easy. If you crack the screen on the phone, can you repair it yourself or take it to any shop? Some manufacturers might stop certain features on your phone if you do. Same goes for expensive combines and tractors on farms. And more manufacturers are creating subscription fees to use features on your product. Some car companies, for example, have fees to use your seat warmer or enhanced acceleration features, again, on the car you bought. Printers get mad at you if you try to use third-party ink cartridges. Our next guest says we're seeing ownership rights chipped away, but we can do something about it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you run into this? Have you tried to repair something or get something repaired, but found out that you could void a warranty or even end up with an unusable product? Have you bought something and then had to pay a regular fee to keep using some features on it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Nathan Proctor is Senior Director for the Campaign for the Right to Repair at USPIRG, the Public Interest Research Group. Nathan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Now, I've heard about the repair issues, and we'll talk about the right to repair concept in a bit. But this new piece you wrote, we've got it linked at WPR.org/Central Time. Something a little different here. How are companies finding ways to get people to keep paying to use features of products they already bought?
Yeah, it's something that is kind of at the heart of the Right to Repair campaign is this premise that you bought it, you own it, you should be able to use it however you want. But because the products that we use now are dependent on software and the internet, there's just all kinds of opportunities for the manufacturer to code them in such a way or to control them through the internet in such a way where they get to tell you what to do with the product. And a lot of times they're using that control to get you to buy more things from the company, more services, you know, upgrades. I mean, people know the printer ink, for example, you know, that if you want to get the printer ink that's made by the company, it's a lot more expensive than the alternatives. But the alternatives, it's very difficult to get them to work. And that's because of the software restrictions that are put inside the printer that just make it hard for the you know, aftermarket companies to supply compatible cartridges. And this is happening. It's going to happen more and more, especially with the internet, because that gives companies the ability to you know, change the terms of use remotely to try to continually, you know, hassle you to get you to buy more stuff from them. And that's wrong.
I shared one of the examples from the piece you wrote. I had not heard of this. A couple of car companies are saying, yeah, your car comes with a seat warmer. And if you subscribe and pay money, you can use the seat warmer and some other features. What is going on in cars?
Well, I mean, the companies that make these cars are being basically pushed to find ways to get more monthly revenue out of the car. And it doesn't matter if it's fair or reasonable in some of these examples. It's just technologically possible. It's actually technologically trivial, right? But it's extractive and wrong. Like that same example, I mean, the first time I heard of that, I was like, well, why wouldn't you just bypass the internet and put a switch there? I mean, the seat heater is physically in the car. It's not difficult to turn something on and off. You don't need an internet connection for that feature. It'd be like if the person who made you, a contractor who built your house, charged you monthly subscription fees so that the light switches worked. I mean, we wouldn't accept that because it's ridiculous, and we shouldn't accept it in our cars either.
There's just a few examples in your piece. If I'm reading you right, your concern is this is just the early wave, and we're going to see a lot more of this kind of thing potentially in consumer products.
Yeah, I was talking with you know, a friend of mine at a child's birthday party, and he said that, you know, in his line of work, there's just these Wall Street guys, he said, come in and they just try to push you to find whatever way you can to find some way to force people to pay monthly for things. And it's, there's so much pressure because there's so much profit margin in that kind of business operation that they're just going to, even if it doesn't make any sense, even if it drives customers crazy, there's just so much money to be made that unless we set up rules to say you're not allowed to do this, it's just going to happen more and more with more different products.
Talking to Nathan Proctor with US PIRG. He heads the campaign for the right to repair there. You can join in at 800-642-1234 as we talk about these ways that companies try to get you to pay for stuff monthly that you already bought from them, and the right to repair and how difficult it can be to repair things yourself or to go to a repair shop unless it's the manufacturer's repair shop. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Ryan is with us in Green Bay. Ryan, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up?
I just want to say, as somebody who's kind of been the family IT repair guy, who's been working on fixing cracked screens since Samsung Galaxy S1, that I find this whole right to repair thing absolutely critical to fighting the, you know, subscription-based model that we seem to be moving for absolutely everything. If we want to talk about vehicles, let's talk about John Deere and how they're affecting the farming equipment that's being used by farmers in our region. If we want to talk about consumer products, we can talk about Apple and their continued fight to not include USB-C standardization in the EU, even though it's been passed by law. I feel like if somebody like me, who knows how to repair things and has, you know, the will to learn how to do so, because I don't have a degree in IT or anything like that, but I can, you know, put a couple screws together and I can remove some glue, I should be able to do that for something that I already paid for. And I shouldn't be stuck behind some kind of firmware wall when it comes to some sort of software keeping me from using my device exactly how I want to. And if anybody wants to look up more of this right to repair stuff in a digestible way, please look up Lewis Rossman on YouTube. I've been following him for years now, and it's just a great resource in terms of trying to figure out what this thing is all about and how important it is to us as consumers in a capitalist society that says we should be able to own things. No, maybe not so much.
Ryan, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Nathan, Ryan, pretty fired up there. Clearly, a couple things he brought up. First of all, he's been replacing screens on his family's phones of various makes and models for years. You write that there was at least for a while an effort to say, yeah, if you start doing that, we're going to start cutting some of your functionality. What did we see there?
Yeah, so in when the iPhone 13 first came out, if you replace the screen, you know, the front-facing camera, which handles the Face ID, is connected to the screen. And if you had it repaired outside of Apple's control, basically without Apple software, it would deactivate Face ID. It would become inoperable. And so eventually Apple pushed out a firmware update that would made it possible for aftermarket, you know, shops to repair the screen. And now it just gives you a warning that, you know, ooh, this was done by somebody who was non-genuine or whatever. And I agree with the caller 100%. And you can just hear how frustrated and annoying it is to be told that you can't do something just because you're not blessed by the manufacturer. I think it's fundamentally un-American. Like, we're a nation of tinkerers and makers. Like, we're not just consumers, like, we're producers. So many of the innovations that make our lives great are things that, you know, people came up with tinkering in their garage, including these companies that are now telling us we're not smart enough to touch our own products. Like, they started in garages. And I think that they need to extend the same kind of collaborative, you know, cooperative hand to us that made their technology possible.
Ryan also brought up a key issue here in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Very expensive farm equipment with proprietary software, unique tools that you might only be able to get at a manufacturer-approved shop. What are we seeing there, Nathan?
Well, first of all, I mean, I would say that for both, you know, these consumer products and farm equipment, we've now won state laws which mandate that the companies like Apple and John Deere have to share the materials that they use in their authorized repair shops with independent mechanics and technicians and product owners. But farm equipment is a huge, you know, leading issue on right to repair, in part because farmers are completely dependent on functional working equipment to make a living and to stay in business and to keep their farm. And when the only way to get something fixed because of a intentional technological lock on the equipment that makes it so you have to use certain software tools to get it working again, and the dealer is the only one in possession of those tools, like, that creates a huge problem for farmers. The biggest problem there is the downtime. If the equipment's not working and you need to get the, you know, the seed in the ground or get the fertilizer down or harvest the crop before a big storm, you're not going to want to be told by the equipment dealer, oh, we can't come out today or we can't come out till 3 weeks from now. One example from Oklahoma in a recent report that we put out, Out to Pasture, said that the dealer told me it was going to be 9 months before they could calibrate the hydraulic, equipment on his equipment so that it would go back into service. 9 months. That's an entire season. That's ridiculous.
Thanks again for that call, Ryan. We're talking to Nathan Proctor from US PERG about a recent piece he wrote on the death of ownership and the ways companies get us to keep paying for things we already bought and make it hard to get our stuff repaired unless we go to the company that made it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like it's gotten more difficult to repair stuff? Electronics, appliances, tractors, you name it. Do you have a product where you have to use something proprietary made by that company? Printer cartridges, coffee refills, you name it, just to use the product you bought? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Nathan Proctor, Senior Director for the Campaign for the Right to Repair at US PERG, the Public Interest Research Group, looking at the way companies make it harder for us to get consumer products repaired and new technologies that make us keep paying to use features on things we already bought, from phones and farm equipment, coffee makers to cars. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Nathan, before I go back to our callers, you mentioned some states are passing laws, including just very recently, our neighbors in Minnesota. What did we see there?
Yeah, Minnesota passed the broadest right to repair law we've seen. It mandates that manufacturers of a lot of products, although unfortunately not including farm equipment, have to share all the parts, tools, and information that they make available for their own authorized networks to fix things to the product owner and to independent shops. So starting in July of next year, it's going to be a lot easier to fix products in Minnesota, everything from, you know, dishwashers and cell phones to, you know, enterprise computing equipment and HVAC and a whole set of other products. And I think it's going to save people a lot of money. And it's going to cut electronic waste. And that's a really, really big deal.
Let's go back to our callers now. Rob is with us in Marquesan. Rob, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Rob?
Microsoft. Recently, they did a deal where they did an update. And basically, all of the Office application on my computer disappeared. And finally got a hold of them on it. And took 3 weeks before they finally gave me a copy of it back, which was a different copy than what I had. So my product key didn't work. I had to spend another week to get the right flavor. But yeah, they did it as part of an update and it just disappeared. And it took almost a month to prove that I paid for it and that they should give it back.
Rob, thanks a lot for that call. Nathan, whether it's a computer or anything else that uses software, that software update, that's a chance for companies to do stuff that consumers like Rob aren't going to be too happy about.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly one of the things that happens pretty frequently is a loss of features with an update. And that can be really upsetting. and you wonder if some of these updates are really to improve the security or the device operation or to accomplish something else. And I think, from a cybersecurity perspective, it's really scary when companies put, you know, kind of other anti-consumer updates in those update files, because we really want people to update everything to the most latest version to patch vulnerabilities that help protect the internet against cybercrime. But people are resistant to doing that because they've had these experiences where they've lost key functionality because an update had some other change in it. And I think that that's definitely something that companies need to pay a little bit more attention to.
Thanks a lot for that call, Rob. Bridget joins us now in Superior. Bridget, hi.
Hi. I had a situation with a air conditioner, and I called the thermal guy who put it in, and he came out and took some parts apart and left it undone. I asked him to come and put it back together. He didn't, and I kept calling about the part. Got to the point where he wouldn't return my calls. Went on, I called different companies, and by the time the next company came, left it exposed, mice had chewed it. So, yeah, so then it wasn't, then they wouldn't cover the warranty, and he wouldn't return my calls.
Bridget, thanks for the call. Nathan, I don't know if this is exactly a right to repair issue, but the idea that if there's only one game in town, only the manufacturer can repair it. If that was the case in Bridget's, I don't think that probably was here, you'd have no recourse. The idea that, okay, there might be multiple places you can go to get something repaired gives us a better chance that we're going to find somebody who can do the job.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would say, you know, your likelihood of getting a good experience with a service technician is really enhanced by competition, you know, kind of weeding the market of people who treat customers like this story we just heard. Like, hopefully we can, the market will squeeze those people out. And so that companies that treat their customers well and charge them a fair rate are the only ones around.
Bridget, thanks for that call. We're talking to Nathan Proctor, Senior Director for the Campaign for the Right to Repair at US PERG. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Aaron is with us in Racine. Aaron, hi.
Hi. I wanted to comment or at least ask for some commentary on the transition to software as a service or computing as a service overall in that we're actually losing access to our computing devices and the software on them in a push for greater revenue and, you know, more pervasive and perpetual licensing of software. You used to be able to buy Microsoft Office one time and use it for a decade, and now Microsoft wants us to buy a perpetual license every year. I'm curious as to your thoughts on that as it relates to the topic.
Interesting, Aaron. Thanks for that. Interesting question. Nathan, what do you think? We used to buy a box of software, install it ourselves, and own it as long as we had that computer. Now it's a service, Aaron says.
Yeah, I mean, this is the blessing and the curse of the internet, right? Where software is not a static application anymore, right? Because, like, I mean, a Nintendo cartridge pretty much plays the same now as it did, you know, back in 1986. But the other games that we're playing are all dependent on the internet. And that just completely changes what we're buying when we buy software. I think that this is a big question. And I think that there, you know, as I argue in the piece that you're referencing, The Death of Ownership, you know, it, at least there's truth in advertisement when Microsoft says what you're paying for is the, you know, continual monitoring and updating of this and you pay monthly. You know, at least you know what you're getting. It's obviously different if they sell you something and you think you bought it outright, but really you just bought the first, you know, entry and now you have to pay monthly to actually use it. So there's separate issues, but I look forward to a world where there's just a lot more transparency, clarity, and options for people to have more control over the technology in our lives. And one of the problems we have in an overly consolidated tech market is, you know, if people would rather just pay once and have something static and lasted exactly the way they bought it, maybe they would. But with so few options in the tech market, there's just not an incentive to create those products because everybody's looking for, you know, these monthly revenue streams. And so they're just going to push us into these systems, whether or not we actually want them.
Thanks for that call, Aaron. And Nathan, talking about transparency, somebody might think, okay, well, I won't buy a product that's going to have this hidden monthly charge to use all of its functions. Is it always that easy to tell when we're buying something that that's going to happen?
I mean, the reason why, like, we have this thing in the Uniform Commercial Code and state laws that it, that protects consumers from unfair and deceptive practices is because you shouldn't have to walk around the Best Buy and think, which of these products is not being marketed to me deceptively to trick me into paying for some monthly thing that I don't know about. Like, we just should not have, you know, you shouldn't walk around the grocery store. Yeah, maybe some of these products that say they're potato chips are really like rat poison. You shouldn't have to worry about that. There should be just standard consumer protection that the products that are being sold are safe and usable. And I think that that's what I'm advocating for, right? If you're going to tether somebody to a secret software arrangement where you get to extract a monthly payment from them, you know, that needs to be exposed and there needs to be transparency there. And people are being, you know, kind of duped by these companies and they find themselves totally dependent on their system, which now all of a sudden is way more expensive than they thought at the outset. And I think that, you know, we should the system should protect consumers from that kind of deceptive product.
Nathan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
That's Nathan Proctor with the Campaign for the Right to Repair at USPIRG. The piece we've been talking about called The Death of Ownership, we've got it linked over at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, disabilities and aging don't have to kick us out of the kitchen. It's Food Friday. We'll get advice on cooking for everybody with the author of the new book, Crip Up the Kitchen. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, wages for American workers have stagnated over the last few decades. The author of a new book tells us that's the result of intentional decisions by business and political leaders from both parties. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the state's largest business group says it may sue the DNR over a new proposed rule on water pollution. We'll find out what's at stake. First, there's been a rise in low-paying service jobs in the United States over the last 50 years, and for the most part, those wages have been stagnant over that time period. One of the big economic schools of thought is that that's the market. Individual wages are determined by the value workers bring to a company. In other words, what you're paid is what you deserve according to market forces. Our next guest says, hang on. In a new book, he says wages are heavily influenced by worker bargaining power, and that since the 1980s, American employers and their political allies in both parties have effectively crushed worker power to the point now where many full-time workers aren't being paid a living wage. He says that's not just bad for the workers themselves. It's a factor in a number of major social problems, and it could tear the country apart. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Are you in one of these lower paid jobs without a lot of prospects for improvement? Did you or someone in your family move from a manufacturing job that isn't there anymore to a service sector job? Do you belong to a union? Do you see the balance of power changing over the last 50 years between employers and employees? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Michael Lind is a historian and columnist at Tablet Magazine. His latest book is called Hell to Pay, How the Suppression of Wages is Destroying America. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Let's start with this idea at the core of your argument that the many low-wage jobs in the U.S. aren't happening just because of market factors, but because of a decline in worker bargaining power. What do you see happening?
Well, the story told by the bipartisan establishment for the last 30 years has been that either because of technology or globalization, you need to improve your human capital to get higher wages. So jobs automatically reflect your skills in a global market or in a high technology economy. And therefore, you need more education or more specific skills in order to get higher wages. I demonstrate in my book, Hell to Pay, that this is nonsense. Globalization and information technology have affected economies in Western Europe and in East Asia, like Japan and South Korea, and they have seen nothing like the extremes of inequality we see in the United States. So if globalization and technology and market forces were behind low wages and proliferating bad jobs in the US, you should see the same effect from the same causes everywhere in the world, and we don't. This is a very American problem.
So what are we doing in the United States that makes it a problem here?
Well, for one thing, deunionization, which has taken place to some degree in Western Europe, is much more extreme in the United States. In the private sector, the number of workers who belongs to a trade union has collapsed from about a third of the workforce in the 1950s to 6% and falling today. That is less than it was under Herbert Hoover before the New Deal. But even for workers who in professions that weren't part of trade unions traditionally, there are all kinds of devices that employers use to eliminate the power of workers to bid for higher wages. For example, there are contractual clauses that you have to sign a contract saying you're not going to compete with a competitor. There are illegal but widespread no poach agreements among firms in the same industry that promise each other, they collaborate secretly, saying they will not hire each other's employees. And that's another technique that reduces the ability of a worker to say, give me a raise or I'll go work for your competitor.
You don't see this as just being something that business leaders are doing. You point the blame also at leaders in both political parties for either changing the legal framework or not enforcing the laws we do have. What do you see happening in that? At least one thing you say some Democrats and Republicans agree on.
Well, the Democratic Party at this point pretends to be the friend of labor, and sometimes it is, but they haven't even been able to pass the PRO Act, you know, a very minor pro-labor measure, and it's way down their list of priorities, frankly, of most Democrats. Now, as I explain in my book, Hell to Pay, there are structural problems with the National Labor Relations Act that created the dominant modern form of organized labor in the United States. Under the NLRA, if you have a national company like Starbucks or Amazon, you can't unionize the whole company at once. Under this 1930s law, you have to organize each Starbucks coffee house or each Amazon warehouse. And that makes unionization much more difficult than it is in Western Europe and other parts of the world, where you have what is called sectoral bargaining. All of the employers in an industry bargain with all of the workers in that industry at the same time.
We're talking to Michael Lind about his new book. It's called Hell to Pay, How the Suppression of Wages is Destroying America. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question for our guest, an experience in the workplace you'd like to share, policy changes you might like to see, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Michael, a lot of your book is about the consequences of what you're calling this long-term suppression of wages. One is we have people in a lot of sectors, retail, restaurants too, who work full-time and to make ends meet have to use some sort of public assistance. Effectively, you say taxpayers are subsidizing employers to pay low wages.
That's exactly right. We have what I call in my book, Hell to Pay, a low-wage, high-welfare system. I don't mean that our welfare state is generous. It's actually very miserly. What I mean is that we have millions of people, between a fifth and a quarter in the United States, who work full-time. They cannot support themselves, much less a child, without means-tested welfare programs like food stamps and housing vouchers and the earned income tax credit. Now, who benefits from this low-income, high-welfare system? It's two groups. Employers of low-wage labor who know that the government will rescue their employers from poverty, even though they don't pay them enough to get out of poverty. And the other group is consumers, in some cases, of goods and services provided by these low-wage workers. So the problem is, this is a case of socializing the costs and privatizing the benefits. The benefits are privatized to low-wage employers who get higher profits by paying lower wages, and to some consumers. The rest of us, the taxpayers of the United States, are basically subsidizing these low-wage employers and low-wage goods and services consumers.
We talk on the show a lot about what falls in the category of deaths of despair, drug addiction, isolation, things like that. You see a direct line from the stagnant wages and these low-wage jobs and a lot of these wider social problems that might not immediately look connected. Connect the dots for us.
Well, we have a number of crises. One is the demographic crisis, which is families having fewer children than they tell pollsters they want to have. And when they're asked why, they say it's economic difficulties. We have a social crisis, and this is linked to the deaths of despair. Young Americans have fewer friends than any generation in American history, including the baby boomers. And part of this, I argue, is because particularly among working class young Americans, many of them have irregular schedules, sporadic work, gig jobs, things like that. It's hard to develop friends and relationships. And if you look at the professional class, which is doing quite well, they have a flourishing social life. You know, that you can, professionals can attend professional conventions. A lot of time they meet their mates, you know, through jobs that have steady payments. So so whether we look at family formation or even things like friendship, which seems like it's completely cultural, I argue that there's an economic element there based on low wages and bad jobs and insecure schedules.
We're talking to Michael Lind. His new book is called Hell to Pay, How the Suppression of Wages is Destroying America. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you and your family? How has wage stagnation affected you? Do you have questions about the balance of power between employers and employees? Maybe policy solutions you would like to see us try? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Michael Lind. His new book is called Hell to Pay, How the Suppression of Wages is Destroying America. We'll go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. We've got Tom with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I wonder if your guest could discuss the case of pay for caregivers, and in particular, child care. And I wonder how much of this is also, if another factor could be just how society values these workers.
Tom, thanks for the call. Michael, you talk some about child care policy in your book. What are your thoughts for Tom?
Well, that's right. Child care workers tend to be among the poorest paid workers in American society, which is really kind of shocking if you think about how important their job is. And if you look at nannies, for example, it's been calculated that the vast majority of the nannies in New York City are paid off the books. They are paid below the minimum wage. They don't have health benefits. Their employers are not providing Social Security. So it's particularly the unregulated side of childcare is a sweatshop industry, and it really needs to be regulated. When it comes to child care policy, there's basically a difference among countries between those which want to give parents the funding to decide whether they want some of that funding to go to a family caregiver or a parent or institutional care. The business community in the United States favors institutional care only because it wants to maximize both parents being in the workforce for their own reasons, to have a larger workforce. So I think if you're pro-worker but pro-family, you know, then you think that we should give child care subsidies to families, but the families should decide how they use them.
Thanks a lot for that call, Tom. Marcus joins us now in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. I was wondering your guest thoughts on kind of like the European model where they cap executive pay, where it can only be, I don't know if it's 50 times the lowest paid worker in any industry for the executives, just so that way they keep some sort of parity. And my other thought is that if you don't have people that are earning a living wage and can actually go out and buy the products that we're producing in this country or that we're importing, how are the people at the top going to continue to receive money? Because they only purchase one garbage can a year or whatever other product. You know what I'm saying? They don't spend enough to actually keep the economy moving.
Marcus, thanks a lot for the call. Michael.
Yeah, two very good questions. I'm not familiar with any European countries that cap executive pay. There may be some that do it, but I'm not aware that that's a European union policy as a whole. If you have strong unions and bargaining power, then they're going to bid up the amount of profits that goes to the workers. And so you don't necessarily have to have a kind of rigid formal system like that. As far as your second question, the U.S. built its global economic primacy on a mass middle class where workers could afford to buy the goods and services they were providing. The danger is that we're splitting into two societies. And economists call this the dual economy model. You find this in many poor countries where you have an elite which buys luxury goods, often imports them from the global market. And then you have just a completely separate economy of shoddy second-class goods for working-class people. So, and the countries that have economies and social orders like that, like many in Latin America, not coincidentally don't have big flourishing home markets for their own producers, and they're not significant industrial countries.
Thanks a lot for that call, Marcus, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Michael Lind about his new book, Hell to Pay, How the Suppression of Wages is Destroying America. Let's go back to your calls now. Stan is with us in Green Bay. Hi, Stan.
Yeah, hi. I'm glad you said that the upper middle class in this country has actually gotten much larger and wealthier. I do agree that the working class on the flip side is struggling. But I'm just wondering, what is your cutoff for a living wage? What is your definition? Because where I live, there's a lot of manufacturing jobs and they're begging for people. And I can tell you what they're paying. But so I'm just curious what your cutoff is.
Well, in my book, I argue against a single definition for the entire United States. We're the third most populous nation in the world, second only to India and China. We have 330 million people and growing. And the standard of living between, you know, Arkansas and North Dakota and, say, big cities in the East Coast, the cost of living, there's enormous variation. So in Hell to Pay, I argue against like a single fixed minimum wage. I think the minimum wage should be raised, the federal minimum wage, and it should be indexed to inflation. But it would be better to have collective bargaining and also mechanisms like local wage boards, where the local cost of living can be reflected in particular industries, not for everybody, but in particular sectors like manufacturing.
Thanks for that call, Stan. And Stan also, Michael, I think alluding to the idea that a lot of people are hiring now. We've seen over the last couple of years some bumps in the lower end of the pay scale, in part because of this weird situation we're in post-worst of COVID. Does that give you signs of hope that lower wages will go up, or do you think this is a blip?
I think it's a blip. This is the third or fourth blip there's been since the 90s. The first one was associated with the tech bubble in 1999, 2000, and then the tech bubble crashed. Then at the end of the Great Recession, after a decade, in 2018-19, wages began rising again, and that's just normal at the end of this quasi-depression like that. And finally, we had the reopening of the economy after the COVID lockdown was much more rapid than business anticipated. And so there was a brief period, which may now be ending, where workers had a lot of bargaining power. But having said that, from what I've seen, inflation has eroded most or all of the wage gains of workers at the bottom. So we need a system in which, even when the economy is running well, workers have bargaining power. You don't have to just wait for the occasional boom separated by long periods of stagnation.
Let's bring on another caller now. We've got Paul with us in Menominee. Paul, hi.
Hi. Could you comment on the huge amount of immigrants that are waiting to get in, are getting in, or are waiting to get in on the borders and the effect that's going to have on wages?
Paul, thanks for the call. Michael, you spend a lot of time on immigration in the book. My read, correct me if I'm wrong, is you don't see immigration as inherently good or inherently bad, but that companies have, in effect, weaponized immigration law to help prevent unionization and keep wages down. Do I have that about right?
Well, it depends on the kind of immigration, whether it's skilled or unskilled, family unification, and so on. There is no doubt, as I show in my book, Hell to Pay, that in specific sectors, the availability of large pools of low-wage immigrant labor, just as there would be if there were large pools of low-wage domestic labor, has allowed employers to destroy unions and lower wages. The Midwestern meatpacking industry was a well-paid, middle-class, highly unionized industry. The presence of, in this case, legal immigrants, for the most part, in the last generation, allowed the meatpackers to wipe out the unions and to lower wages and benefits. And so when people tell you immigrants don't take jobs, immigrants don't take wages, it depends. It depends on the particular sector. And in these low-wage sectors, where with minimal education requirements, the National Academies of Sciences, which is about the greatest authority you can have on the subject, in two studies in 1996 and 2016, said that the, low-wage immigration does indeed lower wages for low-wage workers in the U.S., including many former immigrants. They say, well, it also lowers prices, so some people are better off. But if we really believe that lowering wages to lower prices is a good thing, then we should get rid of the minimum wage altogether.
Thanks for that call, Paul. Michael, I want to spend a couple minutes on some of the solutions you offer. One is to give workers more power. It might not look like going back to, you know, the unionization we might think of from 30, 40 years ago, but some of those sector-based wage things. Could you talk a little bit about your solutions short of unions?
Certainly. In the worst paid businesses and industries, for like retail, construction, fast food, and a few others, I think we should concentrate those immediately because that's where most of the really bad jobs with low wages are. And it's almost impossible to unionize workers, particularly at small fast food establishments and so on. You have to deal with the entire industry simultaneously. And we have a method which dates back 100 years in the United States, and some states have laws on their books about wage boards. Governor Andrew Cuomo raised wages for fast food workers in the state of New York by dusting off, you know, this old statute about wage boards that had not been used for half a century. Now, the way the wage board works, the governor or the mayor appoints a representative of all of the employers in an industry and all of the workers, and the workers don't have to be unionized under this system. And then they negotiate basic standards, wages, schedules, tailored to that particular occupation. So it doesn't apply to everybody in the city or the state. It's fast food workers or another occupation. And that's kind of the quickest, cleanest way, I think, that we can target the lowest paid workers in the United States and raise their wages. And fortunately, many of these service jobs can't be offshored to other countries and they can't be moved to other states. So it means that particular cities and particular states can use this wage board approach as New York City and New York State has done. California is working on a wage commission proposal like this. And you can do it without fearing that you're going to lose business in those particular sectors in your own states.
Michael, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Michael Lind, author of the new book, Hell to Pay, How the Suppression of Wages is Destroying America. Coming up after the news, the state's largest business group has threatened to sue the DNR over a proposed new rule on water pollution. We'll take a look at that proposal, what it would do for lakes and streams around the state. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.